How do we do this again? Welcome to the Two Regular Teachers podcast. My name is Rick Kayla Thompson.
My name's Adam Lavaz. Thanks for joining us for episode 80. And it's a big welcome back, Rick, because it's been a long time.
It's not just the Christmas special, Adam.
It's no, it isn't.
It's the Christmas comeback special. I think we could go with that.
We could go with that. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell podcast. I think we could probably go with. But it is good to be back.
Our actually, jokes haven't got much better.
No, they haven't at all. But it's been a while in the sense that when we sat down and I think it was probably back in November we started to think about doing a Christmas episode. Mm. And we went into our planner that we have and it had been since sort of late March where we'd previously sort of planned an episode but hadn't gone through with it. And that actually kind of opened our eyes a little bit. And we went, actually, it has been a very long time since we've been behind the microphone.
Yeah, it's not far off 12 months, Adam, is it?
No,
it's just under 12 months. And nothing much has changed in our lives as educators in that time. But we thought, looking ahead to 2019, perhaps we can try and get the ball rolling again. And either way, it's just nice to be churning one out before the end of 2018,
Adam. It is. And I think having been away for so long, is a little bit reflective, I think, of the job today. I think, you know, you and I stepped away a little bit because we had a lot going on, you know, a lot in our job and a lot we had to prioritise, you know, and you know, you're leading your team at your school and I'm leading wellbeing at my school and things, and that comes up and sometimes some things unfortunately have to give way, and the podcast for just a few terms was one of those things. But we're really excited to be back in the chair and really excited about the prospect of potentially more podcasts in 2019.
Well, one of our topics tonight is looking back on the year that's been, isn't it?
It is.
Hasn't it, Adam? And in terms of the state of education, I'm looking forward to talking about that because things have happened and even evolved again, even in the short time that we've been away.
So it's classic stuff, really, isn't it? It's always evolving from term to term. Yeah. But everyone who, our regular listeners will know that with a Christmas podcast comes a special guest. And we've had a few different ones over the years who have kind of been okay, but none have actually reached the level of this. Who's sighing over there already as I talk him up. Well, I'm putting him under the pump by doing this.
Well, can I say, Adam, and our regular listeners might recall that our last correspondence, and it's so glad to see him sitting in the flesh across from us, because I was concerned, because the last correspondence was quite a murky response, you know, a little bit. It was difficult to hear. He was. Yeah. I think the waves were crashing.
Last time he was away.
He was on
right.
a boat somewhere, and he might regale us with a bit more about that shortly. But welcome back, Two Regular Teachers' Own Father Christmas. I've used it before, John Pierce. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, gentlemen. Yeah. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be in the room again.
Yes. Can you cast your mind back to last year's episode? I mean, I think you said you'd stowed away, so to speak. On the bunk bed, boat swaying, and you were able to get something to us?
Well, it was a rare pleasure. It was a time, one of those rare times, when you can actually take one of your parents away for a holiday and do something that she'd never done before.
Yeah, brilliant.
And that was a cruise, a multi-island cruise, mind you.
Oh, you've got to get that in there.
Yeah, we are. Yes, Tasmania and Phillip.
brilliant.
So, unfortunately my father passed away during the year previous, and it was an opportunity to do something for mother that she hadn't done before, and that was to take her and my sister on this cruise, and it was a fabulous time.
And would you say, if we tie it into what we're talking about tonight, would you say that even at that late age for your mother, it was there a learning experience in there for her? Do you think it was just something that was out of her comfort zone?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the things that sort of kicked it off was the fact that one of her earliest holidays that she ever took was a single female to go to Tasmania,
right.
And she had a picture of herself atop Mount Wellington.
Ah, yes,
and that, and
unbelievable.
So this was a journey back to that time,
and were you able to recreate?
We did manage to get up to the top of Mount Wellington.
Fantastic.
We had a fabulous taxi driver who'd never been up there, and gave us a quote of $70 to get up to the top, and he said, if we don't get back down again, I'll just turn the meter off, which he did.
Oh, good on him.
And when we got back into Hobart, there'd been a traffic accident on the bridge, and Hobart was jammed.
Ah.
And we had no idea what time the ship was to sail.
Oh, no.
We thought it was 4:30, but it might have been 4:00. And we were 3:45 and not going anywhere till about 4:15.
It was a genuine learning experience in patience.
It was, yes. Oh. The taxi had been full of conversation up until we hit the traffic.
Yes.
Yep.
And then that, and then
that,
it was
that awkward silence that, you know,
the gnawing of fingernails.
Watching the clock,
and
yes.
That's brilliant.
Needless to say, we made it back in time, and I think there were around about 500 other people who hadn't made it back, plus about 120 crew.
Oh. Yeah, right. They're all stuck.
Well,
absolutely. And even in all that, John's commitment to the podcast, he still found time to send something through.
Well, he made it home. Yes. And it is good. And I think you were back in time, John, for plenty of things. And I think, without getting too political, I did want to mention that we've just come out of a state election, haven't we, here?
We have indeed.
In Victoria. We obviously moved from Tasmania now. And
you could almost not call it a state election. It was almost a state bloodbath, by the way. Daniel Andrews stormed home to victory, really. He just absolutely smashed everyone to pieces.
It was. And our intention is not to show our sides here or anything like that, but certainly education came up, and we'll touch on it later. Did come up in terms of at times in the campaign, didn't it?
Did, yeah. It always does.
Certainly money and politicians being spotted at schools.
And how politicians perceive an advantage, a possible advantage, and the way they pitch things. And yep. I think it was reasonably obvious that the stuff that the opposition pitched was simply not attractive to people.
No.
It was far too niche, far too simplistic, and didn't take into account the bigger picture.
And I think I think that's a fair call. I think even pundits on both sides have kind of said that, haven't they?
And you always get, before you go into that one, you always get when they go to the schools, that stock photo of, you know, them behind a group of kids in front who are all smiling with hands waving, and they're leaning in behind smiling and as if to say, hey, I'm happy to be here, when really they're just looking for votes.
Yes, I think the ones that I enjoy the most is them sitting at a prep table with knees up around their ears, yeah, looking like they're taking a guided reading group. And I think,
exactly. Yeah, you don't know what 2 + 2 is, do you? Those kids have got you covered. Where's your thrust chart, Andrews?
but to be fair to some of them, sometimes some of that's also the media.
Yes, that's true.
And there was a classic picture that appeared in the local paper during the year, promoting the Stephanie Alexander Garden.
Of course. Yes.
And there were a group of kids there, standing there, and mind you, this is, I think, around August, September, when there's not much growing in your garden. But these guys have got in hand various things that have been grown in tropical climes, including a pineapple that was actually turned to face the camera with, you know, the sticky label still on it. Yeah. This is what we've grown in our garden, guys.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
okay.
Right, yeah.
Was Stephanie in that photo?
No. It was the local guy. So obviously the camera guy's been sent out, you know, get a picture. We don't care what it looks like, as long as we've got kids holding on to something.
No one gave him a memo about seasonal fruit.
No, not at all.
Before we move into our first topic tonight, Adam, I think it's worth mentioning for the three of us tonight, and I'm sure there's many more of our listeners out there, that yourself will be becoming a father for the first time within the next month.
Second time. You said for the first time then.
Did I say the first time?
Yeah,
second time.
You're giving me information I don't have here about my first one, eh?
Right, so. No, I think no. I'm just...
So I'm father for the second time for me in January. Rick is very excited to be a father for the first time in February. And John also is going to be a grandfather for what we're thinking is...
The umpteenth time
in 2019 as well. So there's lots of that going on. That's been a big year for us in terms of, not having the time to do the podcast as well with those things going on.
Be productive in another way.
That's what but it's exciting times, isn't it, Rick?
Oh, look, it sure is, Adam. In all seriousness, the chance to become a father... being in this profession is something that I think adds another level to the whole experience, which you both know, and I can't wait.
And we want to give a quick shout out to Lee Burns, a long time listener and a very good friend of ours, who just had his second child, a daughter, Holly. I think it was earlier in the week. So congratulations to you, Lee. We hope yourself and the family are doing very well.
Well, we actually asked Lee. I asked Lee if he'd be able to leave us some thoughts on his on education as a little audio, and now I understand why.
Why he's been?
I'd misplaced the due date there, Lee. So
absolutely.
Apologies.
So the intro is now going almost 10 minutes. So we probably need to work our way into the first topic. And like we do have some good ones tonight, some light-hearted ones to get ourselves back in it. So without further ado, let's get cracking.
All right, Adam, for our first topic tonight, our first main topic, I noticed I thought this might lead us into our discussion about the state of education at the end of 2018. We mentioned in the intro that it's been quite a gap since our last podcast, and as teachers we feel like, again, the wheels turned, you know, some new things have come in, old things are being spoken about again, some things stay the same. Yeah, yeah. Buzz terms, yep. And something I thought that might be just a nice way to lead into it was ABC News Victoria posted just a little tweet asking for some opinions during the week. The Federal Education Minister, Dan Tehan, is calling for a revamp of the national curriculum. He mentioned this about two mornings ago, flagging a need to emphasise core subjects like maths and English over soft skills, in inverted commas, like leadership and teamwork. So it got me thinking, Adam, that with a federal election coming up too early in the new year, that this could be and will be a hot topic, particularly with the government trying to get through their Gonski 2.0 funding. But it just made me think about this cycle of education and the things that different governments say that are then put onto the departments, that are then put onto schools. And it got me thinking about, do we need, firstly, and I'll start with this, do we need to revamp the national curriculum again so soon, when schools have only just really worked out their essential learnings for the current curriculum?
Oh, no, I don't think so. And it almost comes up, and John, you might be able to talk about this too, in terms of, I mean, I think about the curriculum, and I've been teaching like 12, 13 years, and I've already been through enough to count on one hand, you know, in that time. And that almost gets towards averaging out a new curriculum every 2 years. I mean, you've had the CSF, we've had the VELS, we've had the AusVELS, we've had, there's the national curriculum there, then there's the Victorian curriculum in there. That is just in, for me, just a little over a decade's worth of teaching. I mean, John, you would have seen far more curriculums come and go in that time than I have. That would be correct.
Indeed. And in fact, you know, when we started out, it was really hard to say. The word curriculum as such wasn't in the lexicon. So that's an interesting thing to ponder.
Yeah.
It was, as I've got along here, a set of materials that are fairly interesting, but course of study was more the vernacular than a notion of curriculum.
And even in reading that and looking at it, we've had a brief look before we came on, a lot of the ideas behind it is not too dissimilar to what we have today. Would that be correct?
Indeed. Yeah. It's
well, I think that's the interesting point, I think, isn't it? It's about the language around syllabus and curriculum that still gets used today. I just want to paint a picture and go to the blog and look on the Facebook page. There'll be a photo that John has brought in, this giant volume. I think it made a sort of sound when he laid it on the bench.
Dust flying everywhere.
Lovely musty. I love the musty smell of books. John, it looks like you need to be wearing white gloves turning those pages. And it should be behind glass.
Yeah, it should be
almost. But this was de rigueur. This in the day. This was the stuff that you worked out of. Mm. Now I must say that this is not necessarily the stuff that I taught with. It was the stuff that was being taught to me. So it takes back. This is the English curriculum of 1955, which has been revised in 1960 with the book lists changed.
Wow,
So there you're looking at 5 years, basically, with some book lists and changes. Most of the other stuff stays the same.
Which is
quite interesting in terms of what you're saying, Adam.
Yeah.
You know, that how much, you know, curriculum supposedly has to change to reflect.
Yeah.
What I noticed when I had a flick through earlier, off air, was that even that, as old as that is, to me, it was almost a little bit more conversational in the way that it describes how to go about teaching compared to, I guess, the very formal statements we have, these I can essential statements that we have these days.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, it's really an overview. Yeah. There's no... my God, I'm just going a blank.
Well, there's no learning goal statements as
yes,
such.
Yeah. The little indicator thingies, which have gone straight out of my brain, and you know, the
progression points,
content standards, and
the elaborations is the word I'm looking for. There are no the elaborations, they just don't, they're not there. So,
but what jumps out to me too is that where you say there's just a change of book list and stuff, it seems like today that every education minister that comes in, the first thing they feel they need to do is put their mark on the roll by changing the curriculum. And it ends up being very minor change. And I don't actually think the public at large and parents things understand how difficult that can be for teachers and teaching staff aides and assistant principals and principals to get their head around it, because there are changes, because you develop a lot of your, you know, core assessments and things around this curriculum. And then when a brand new one's brought in, you have to go back and find the time to change it all over again to fit these new content descriptors and essential learnings and all these sorts of things that, and get used to it. And because some will have a focus on certain things in maths more over others and things, and you've got to change everything constantly without it really making an impact. I mean, if you look at the stats, Australia's still a middle of the park sort of across the world in terms of our results. Nothing's really changed with the changing of these curriculums.
There's a lot of unpacking that needs to happen when things change, which is time consuming for schools.
One of our problems has often been that education and curriculum becomes the province of pre-existing culture wars, as it were. So we have diametrically opposed positions in terms of where we're looking at reading. Okay, so we've got our phonics and we've got our whole word. You know, that were the two main points of focus that hold sway. But the reality is that most teachers teach somewhere in the middle. Similarly with so much of your history and that sort of stuff, it's, you know, how much do we teach Western history as opposed to world history, as opposed to the history of the Australian Indigenous people and so on.
So to go with that, because we can come back to the original quote from Dan Tehan, where he said we need more focus on literacy and numeracy over soft skills, which I must admit I haven't heard the term soft skills before, so I instantly think he's bagging those skills, which he's not. That's sort of the term, but a lot of people at large may not understand that. But do we need to have more focus on literacy and numeracy as opposed to leadership, teamwork, even things like well-being and things?
When are we not? That's my question. Not 1 year in my curriculum can I recall where there's not been, we need to lift our literacy results. All our leading teachers in schools, in our public schools, are normally around literacy and numeracy, aren't they?
Because it's 5 hours a week for each. Like we set our five hours. Is he saying potentially, because you need to unpack the quote and find out more, but is he saying 6, 6, 6? You know, like an extra hour of each of them, you know, maybe other things have got to go, and, you know, because where would you fit it? You wouldn't fit it in.
We need to test it better.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. No.
Yes.
And that cry has... Yep. It's probably reflected in some places in industry and everything else, but one of our problems there is too, that the expectations and that of people leaving school and going into the workplace. Once upon a time, you could leave the school with not very high levels, and you could get into apprenticeships and things like that, and you could learn on the job, and you could get by. Mm. And the reality is now that those entry level things now have all moved up the chain quite a bit. So the people who are looking at those entry, the employers looking at those entry level people, are seeing people who are less qualified, less able, less capable than they had in the past.
Absolutely.
So
can I steer you back then to the giant volume of the course studies? Can you give us, if we think about what Adam was saying then about what gets pushed out and, you know, how do we balance all these? What subjects, and you were mentioning this off air, John, what things are standing out? I know there's some subjects that are in these course materials where there's quite a lengthy section on some surprising subjects when you compare to perhaps what a lot of primary schools, particularly in our state, are doing at the moment.
There's a lovely section here, Needlework, 1956. And it is a stunning set of pages, replete with decorative stitches, telling you how to do the herringbone stitch, cross stitch, and other decorations, and how to put your buttons on to make a person riding a scooter.
But it's amazing.
Fabulous. Yeah. But of course, we gentlemen, we would never have seen any of this because we would have been doing woodwork.
Yes, of course.
And other things.
Now, music, I noticed, had quite a large section, even with sheet music included, which to our music supporters in terms of our people who talk about STEAM with the arts. I mean, that's almost lovely to see.
It takes up about a fifth of the
about
volume.
A fifth of the volume,
Yes. And now we have the situation where music is not taught at all. No. Or maybe you'll bring a guy in a van and he'll take some classes after school.
Which is what we've got. We've got the music bus comes in one day a week, and there's another a guy who comes in and does some piano and stuff like that. But it's apart from a concert year, it happens. You might do a bit in concert year, where you do a bit of music and you do a bit of singing and that sort of. But outside of that, it's really hard to fit in.
Full-time music program at our school, which is really extremely rare.
Yeah, that's fantastic. With a proper music teacher who can do all the stuff.
Bands and everything. And I don't know of another public primary school that does it. I know there are in terms of our region and people I know. Yeah.
Yeah, so, one of my most enjoyable year teaching was when I had to teach music. Yeah. And I'm not that musical. As recall,
we sat around the campfire one camp together, didn't we, with the year six kids. I remember there was, you churned out a few tunes on that guitar.
Good enough to fill the kids. But
old MacDonald had a Ford.
Yes.
One of my favourites.
When you went to Summer's camp, you learned all the songs down there. And you used to turn them out.
Of course.
It really opened my eyes in terms of, okay, this is what music could be and that sort of stuff. Mm. Fortunately, there was a music teaching package in the school that was really pedagogically well-backgrounded and it was easy to access. Mm. One of the great days was doing some scat singing with grade fives, and having them come in, going, and then they go, by the end of it, we were bouncing off the walls and
So to me, just to finish off, because I know we want to keep moving, that course study there screams to me that it's written for anyone to be able to come in and teach it. So if you hadn't taught music before, you could pretty much pick that up and go, right, so I need to start with this one, here's what I need, you can read it and actually then sort of teach it. Whereas today, obviously, unless you're qualified to do it, you probably won't be tasked with having to teach it. That's what that sort of course study screams to me.
Yeah. One of the nice ones is that it's opposite with the conversation before. Any extent to which English is to be consciously taught all through the school day.
Mm.
So it's saying to us that English is the thing that we teach with, not we teach to and of.
Yes. And that's a really good thing to remember.
Really, really interesting. And even for that time, for that era, you did say it's very, what was the word? It's very kind of polite, Western.
Oh, the
middle class. A lot of excluded elements, which listeners who know their history.
The social studies.
Yes. Correct social studies, in inverted commas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that in, John.
Yeah,
absolutely
fantastic.
Wonderful. And we've only barely scraped the top of the iceberg with where education is, but I think you'll notice that it'll be a theme that kind of runs throughout tonight's episode. I think
it will be. So look, we want to throw it out to our listeners with that quote. We'll try and get it up there on the blog and on the Facebook page. If you've got any thoughts on that, we'd love to hear them, because it is a loaded quote. Do we need to spend more time on literacy and numeracy over those what Dan referred to as soft skills, or do people actually believe, no, we really do have the right mix? And as John said before, do we need to test better? And even from that, do we need to learn to teach it better? So guys, our second topic for tonight is a little bit of a lighter one. And obviously, we're not far away from Christmas. We're not far away from the end of the term. And I thought I'd touch on the changes in schools in terms of what they do at Christmas time, what we did in Christmas time when we were back in primary school, and what even was taught and what was allowed to be taught in the years gone by. And I touch on this because I think more and more schools are trying to go away from those Christmas activities. Now, I know for me, when you get towards the end of the year, particularly up in the 5-6 area, the kids start to not be disengaged, but they can almost smell high school on the horizon. They go their transition days, and the Christmas activities can be a fallback, because you can really, I find in the classroom, the Christmas activities can be the best opportunity sometimes through the year to do some real art and craft. You know, because the kids go off to art and STEAM and they do lots of those things. But to make big things, and do some engineering and these sorts of things and building the Christmas trees is brilliant. But there is a big push, not necessarily from individual schools, but I think from the education department as a whole, that they want you to stay away from any sort of Christmas activities and some of the problems that they can bring for as long as you possibly can. And Rick, I know that you've got a few things you want to mention there as well.
Well, I want to go even bigger, more broad than necessarily just whether you do an activity or not. It's interesting these days. I heard at a school where a team were discussing whether they do Kris Kringle in the classroom. The kids were keen on doing it, just a simple little Kris Kringle. And the question was asked by leadership, is that in our policy? Is Kris Kringle in the policy? And it just got me thinking about how times have changed. You know, there's nothing's innocent anymore. Granted, you're going to have students in your class who might be from a family, believe in a particular religion, don't celebrate Christmas. It's something you've got to take into account. It's happened to me before. But I just wonder about that. Is it in your policy? And I think, you know, we've talked about Christmas. Our regular listeners will know we've talked about Christmas before. But I just wondered, what are your... John, do you have memories of Christmas as a theme or anything in the times that you were teaching? Or probably, I'm assuming it was just something just happened.
Yeah, look, once the reports had gone out, you know, you're left with, well, okay, we can fill in, we can watch videos and everything else and that sort of stuff. Mm. But I used to take the attitude that that just allows more opportunities for things to go wrong, kids to mess up and everything else and that sort of stuff. So what we what I used to do with colleagues I was working with was to get together a set of activities that sort of had some sort of literacy aspect to it. Maybe we'd write a story, maybe we'd write a cartoon, maybe we'd something different that didn't necessarily happen during the year, but had some sort of attachment to Christmas. And you know, there were 20 or 30 activities on that sheet, and you go and you can choose one from each of the four or five areas, and once you've chosen them, you've made a contract. You do it. And so, you know, that might have been making a Christmas decoration that made a noise.
Yeah, right.
Okay, you there was a problem attached to it. You weren't just making a Christmas decoration, you had to do something anything else. And then the kids just basically came in the morning, sit down, and if you hit a wall with one, you'd get onto one of the other ones.
Yeah, which is a great idea, because it always comes back to me that the mentioning of reports. Because that's the big one. Because when you finish your reports go out, you ask them, they're going, well, there's no point starting anything new. I mean, that it's the end of the year. You're waiting for next year's teacher. That's when they pick it up and continue, because it's the middle of December. Do you guys think as well with the Christmas activities and stuff, we probably wouldn't need to do them if we didn't finish so close to Christmas? I mean, you look at the high schools and some of them when the times the kids finish there. I mean, if we finish at the end of this week, reports could go out on the Friday. Everyone could go home, you could do your things and get ready for Christmas, but you've got to teach that extra week, and you sort of think, is that required? Do we need to be teaching that extra week?
Well, I get back to the question about, you know, is it in your policy? I mean, do you have to have a Christmas theme? I mean, I like Christmas and I celebrate it, but, you know, it's not in the policy. That doesn't say you must cover Christmas.
Does it
like John's activities suit? They would never need a Christmas theme, but they're still problem solving, and the kids are still learning. And like you said, it's so important though, John, to try and, because if you don't, you do, you're going to lose them, particularly the year sixes, very quick if you don't plan these things.
The flip side of the policy though, is it in the policy to say you can't? It was in the policy to say that you can't do Christmas activities until December the 4th or something like that. Because I feel like it works both ways. I think these days though, teachers are well aware. I think you'd be a brave teacher on December the 1st to start putting up Christmas activity, like Christmas decorations and doing those things, because the kids go, you little beauty, and you still got 20 days left. I do think there's some merit in the fact that as soon as you pull out some decorations, as soon as you pull out some activities, the kids go, we're done. It's almost that sort of that subconscious of, we're done, we're finished up. And that's what you were saying before, John, that the kids can, you know, to paraphrase, go a bit feral, and, you know, they're harder to contain, and they're, you know, those sorts of things like that. So you've got to be wary of that. And I think teachers today are... just use their common sense when it comes to those Christmas activities.
Well, I'm intrigued to ask, and I'm going to just steer it down a slightly different path here, Adam. I'm intrigued to ask John, and I'm just going to give you a little anecdote to lead you in, John, about gifts you may have received. Being Christmas and being teachers, you know, we often can receive lovely gifts, Adam. We've talked about previous podcasts. One year I was encouraged, and I fell under the spell. I was encouraged by a colleague to make a mention of perhaps something either that I didn't want for Christmas that I didn't want any more of, or something that I liked. And I've only done it once, and I mentioned the fact that I don't eat a lot of chocolate, which is true, and that I've got enough mugs, in a polite way, enough coffee mugs.
To laugh your last
then, then I happened to mention that I do enjoy a glass of wine with dinner, just one glass.
This
is not that long ago, I got no chocolate. I was regaling a parent about this story recently who asked me something. I got no chocolate this particular year, no mugs, and cleared 16 bottles of wine. Now, some people would be celebrating with that. I walked out with the heaviest bag, and there was just something
Have you still got some of them?
No comment. But however, there was something that my conscience played on me, though. I just thought I just felt a little bit.
Have you done it again since?
No, I haven't. That's the truth. I haven't. Yeah. John, anything in terms of gifts you can recall in your career that stood out? Or
my standard rejoinder was, I don't want anything special as long as it's big and expensive. I don't care.
And did you get some big and expensive things over the job?
Actually, the best one, if you're talking about the best one, and it was a family that did it every year, so it was not particularly pertaining to me as such, but they took out, there were two girls in the family, and they took both of the teachers for that year to the Empire Grill.
Wow. All
right, I remember that.
That's brilliant. Yeah. What a great idea.
And the kids were babysat, so the parents, and that sort of stuff, and it was a fabulous evening.
Because I really like that, because I know some people might go, oh, yeah, you shouldn't be going there. Yeah. But my comeback to that always is because I've developed some really great relationships with parents over the years, particularly in a smaller school.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm only a teacher once. Why wouldn't I take the opportunity to build those relationships? And if it's a strong enough relationship where you get along really well and say, hey, for Christmas, we'd love to spend some time with you to say thank you and take you out for a meal, why wouldn't you do that? What is wrong with doing that? I'm only a teacher once. If I develop that, that's down to me and the effort I have made with their family and their child and what I've done for them and that sort of stuff. I reckon that's a rip-roaring idea.
So our listeners out there, we've probably asked you before, but we're going to ask you again. What experiences have you had at Christmas as a teacher, whether it's gifts or the kind of policy that your school has in place or the activities you do? We'd love to hear from you before Christmas.
Yeah, so you don't get any lint balls like I always get.
G'day, Adam.
G'day, mate.
How's your end of year tracking?
Yeah, pretty good, but very busy at the moment.
Well, I'll come to your room and take your kids so you can clean up your classroom.
Things ever said in the staff room.
Well, Adam, for our third topic tonight, and it's a big one for me, it's been probably one of the things that's really stood out during our hiatus from the podcast in terms of what's happened in education this year in terms of our jobs and on the ground, is the big focus, and it's coming from department level now, on positive education and the kids' responses to their attitudes to school survey. So to backfill for our listeners outside the state particularly and outside the country, probably around late May, early June each year, the year 4s, 5s and 6s in the public schools complete what they call the attitudes to school survey, a response to a series of statements about how they're feeling at school. Everything from, are they stimulated in their learning, to how they feel about whether their teacher cares for them or not. And we've been doing it, I think, probably since I began the job. But there's been, particularly this year, a focus. It's even in the annual strategic plan now, the annual implementation plan in schools, for them to lift this data.
Mm.
It can be measured. And I thought it'd be an interesting one to talk about. It's been a big topic at our school this year. Something that we've had to focus on, curriculum changes, timetable changes, what you offer in terms of subject changes, surveying the kids outside the attitudes to school survey, you know, creating your own surveys to see any growth. And I wanted to riff on, and it kind of links to, you know, the Dan Tan comment about the soft skills. And it's not that I'm against this, I think I'm all for it, but, you know, there's all of a sudden now we've got leaders talking about how important the relationship is that you build with your students.
Mm.
And I sometimes get the impression like it hasn't happened before. You know, not, you know, and for some of us like myself, that's the bread and butter. That's the stuff that still gets me up in the morning.
Yeah.
And I guess I wanted both opinions, particularly, I'm interested tonight with someone like yourself who's still in the job, John, who's been out of the job for a little while but has his finger on the pulse still, and thinking about back to when you were teaching, John, about, I'm going to try hard not to be cynical here, but I find all of a sudden it's all buzz because we can measure it, or we're more aware of how we can measure it now.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
I'll jump in first, if you don't mind, John, because it really speaks to me, because I'm my school's wellbeing leader. You know, that's just sort of come in this year as part of the AIP, and I love it and stuff. And I think this has been a long time coming. I think for a long time, how a student feels and about school and themselves has been overlooked for a long time. It's whether or not they can do literacy and numeracy and things. If they can't do it, you know, they just can't do it, they don't know it. I actually think half of the battle for a student is how they feel every morning when they come to school. If they're coming to school happy and engaged, then what you're doing on the board, they have more chance to learn it and to understand it and to take it all in than someone who's coming in unhappy, or for whatever reason it is they're being unhappy. So I think the opportunity to measure it and the opportunity to look at it is extremely important, because I think a lot of people in our schools think they put the emphasis on it, but I also think sometimes it's still a very underrated and overlooked aspect of our teaching profession, that if you have the ability to build a relationship with a student and engage with them, that is half the battle. They are going to come to school going, whatever you are doing out the front there, I'm engaged, I'm going to listen, I'm going to want to do it because you know me and you know how I learn and you understand me, and I can talk to you about things and share those things with you. They are going to want to come in and learn. And I think the opportunity, yes, but jump in, playing devil's advocate there, were you?
I'm just interested. Like, well, John, let's hear
you first. I'll give you a butt there, because you just identified something that's really, really critical, that sort of gets lost in so much of the debate now. You said that you as a teacher really know,
yes,
that particular student and know something about them and what makes them tick and everything else, that sort of stuff. Yet so much of what we do now with all of these surveys and everything else almost suggests that you don't know enough about them, that we actually have to find out more about them.
Yes.
I'll feed you another anecdote back. I do some work out at Deakin University with people who are coming into university and that sort of stuff. Now, everybody at Deakin completes a survey, has the capability to complete a survey about how they feel about what's happened in their particular units and everything. Up until last year, I know that people had done it, and I've been doing this for about 5 years now. I've never, ever, ever actually found out what was in the surveys. I just did it on trust.
Yeah, right.
And, something came through with the email after this last lot and said, and they gave me a score. And that was the first time I've ever got the score.
Yeah.
Now, it was a pretty good score.
Yeah. Which is great.
But it was 92%.
Yeah.
Okay, so whatever 92% means, I think it's pretty good. Is that going to likely to change the way I go about anything and that sort of stuff? Probably not.
No.
Because you get the feel in the class, you get the feel by the fact that, you know, they turn up.
Mm.
They might kick back occasionally when I ask them to think and do something different and that sort of stuff, but they still turn up the next week.
Mm.
And
that's right.
And this links to what I was going to say too, because it links back to what Adam said about building that relationship and knowing the student. But when that student sits down to complete this survey, and I'm talking about a student younger than the ones you were talking about, do they know how to answer? What if they feel that trust with the teacher, and they, even if they to some degree they know that Adam knows them and they have a good relationship, do they know how to translate that into the survey? Because the students that I've worked with over the last couple of years, some of them don't seem to.
Yeah.
And that's what's concerning leadership, is so how do we make them understand that? Are we asking the right question?
Yeah. And they asking the question too many times. I mean, you could grab that Attitudes to School survey and go, the same question is written 5 different ways. Yeah. And some of them are so ambiguous, and the kids, and also how they choose how to answer it and things like, and they get it mixed up, and it's just.
But I've asked the question too, that is it where school still sits in our culture and society?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that if I actually really do like my teacher, and I, you know, I would like them to know that, but my two mates over here might not.
Yeah.
So even if they never see my survey, I don't feel comfortable saying I love school and my teacher, because it's not.
Yeah.
Because I've got to fit in with that.
Yeah. That's right. I've got to fit in. Yeah.
So what we'll probably need to do is we will have to actually institute classes which actually teach the kids how to understand the test, understand the survey, so that then they can answer in the best possible way. So we'll just add another hour to the week.
Well, that's the thing. I was just about to say, even in that, how ridiculous does that sound? I mean, we were talking because we're...
but that's happening. I mean, there's explanations around, you know.
I'm being extremely facetious.
Of course you are, that's what I mean, even the thought of that. You
but
know?
It's, yeah.
Look, at our school at the moment, we're developing our behaviour matrix for the school-wide positive behaviours, which has been brilliant. But even some of those discussions where we put the words in, there's instantly a discussion of, kids won't understand that word. And my comeback is, well, we need to teach them. As part of what we're doing, we need to get them to understand what the word encouragement means, what the word kindness actually means, what the word, you know, determination and resilience and all these sorts of, we need to teach them through our and that's not dedicating, say, now we were talking about, you know, 10 minutes on a Monday morning before they get started. It's a quick lesson about, you know, what are we focused on this week? What does it mean? What does it look like? We need to teach them that.
It's there against one of those tensions between the system and the school.
Yeah.
The school focus in our particular school is, look, we just want the kids to not vandalise the place.
Other
schools, you know, we want our kids to be off out into the community, you know, looking after our aged care, yada, yada, yada. And that's the stuff. How do we encompass that in a one-size-fits-all survey?
Yeah, it's very hard. The terminology,
the other bits and pieces.
Yeah.
So why can't we trust the school to understand and come up with their own measures?
I want to, you know, and as we get towards the end of the segment, though, and you'll remember this, John, I want to touch on something that's about my own experience was, you might recall, I've been doing it for many years, but the scoop that, that I've done before with the kids. So the first 10 minutes of the morning, a random topic, you know, in a diary the night before, the kid comes with those facts. And that was something I've been doing since day one. That just came to me. But I always remember someone at my previous school, someone higher up than me, coming to me one morning and saying, what are you doing, while it was happening? Because we had a whole school activity happening in numeracy that morning. There were visitors, and this particular girl had brought in a really old-fashioned typewriter. And so I thought, we have to do this. And she, this person said to me, I said, well, we're doing the scoop, is what we always do before we... So I'm going to do that before we start this numeracy activity. And she wasn't pleased about that, that I was doing this before the rest of, you know, before the rest of the school had started. And then I thought, okay, so, and then the question was asked later, well, yes, you can do it, but how can you link it to the actual learning or your literacy block? And then, let's fast forward 5-6 years, different school. Now it's being talked about as a whole staff. You need to do 10 minutes in the morning and sit, even if you just have a conversation with them, or go for a walk around the oval and have a quick brain break before you start. And I sat there and I thought, great idea. However, I thought, I've been doing this for whatever years. Now, I'm not saying that I'm the be-all and end-all as a teacher. I'm just saying it just makes me think of that cycle of education as well.
Yeah, it does. But how much of the students were going to get so much out of that? An old typewriter and the facts and talking about it. I mean, that could really get some kids going, I'm going to go and look that up. I've actually had...
That's the thing they talk about still.
For our writing as well, we were doing our writing this term at a writer's gift. One of the kids actually brought in, they wanted to do their publishing on a typewriter. So, of course, they brought it in and we showed it and we talked about it. That's the essence of school to me. That is brilliant sort of stuff. We should never, under any circumstances, be stamping on that. Or coming back and going, how are you linking this in or something like that? We shouldn't have to link everything. This is just pure learn in its purest form.
Well, it's relationships too.
Yeah. Who are the links for? The links for us or the links for the kids?
Yeah.
You just said, you've identified it. The kids have made the link from something to something else in their world.
Yes, that's right. That's
what education is all about.
Yeah, that curious creativity and all those sorts of things. So,
and there's a value judgment that they've made.
Yep.
This is really important to me. Can I bring along?
It's brilliant, isn't it? And I just think, just to finish off, I don't know if you want to jump in there too, Rick, I'm sorry, but the well-being of our students and how they feel and the relationships we build can never be undervalued. I actually don't think we can value it enough.
No, but
it's so important.
That was the good thing about the scoop.
Yes, that's
right. Every kid for one day in the year.
Yeah.
Was really important.
Yes.
And the work done behind the scenes to actually be able to bring that out into kids, and I know Rick did this a number of times with kids that I can't do anything. I don't know, I can't. Everybody's got something and you just have to search it, grab it, help them, discover it.
Yeah.
I'm important. I'm at the front.
I'm on display. Everyone's
I am the man,
me.
I am
yeah,
the girl,
that's right.
I am the person.
Yeah, it's great.
Thanks, John. And I think Mike, and just to finish off with, I guess, a question for everyone to ponder is, and I'm certainly not against data, but the measuring of all this, is it what we need? Or do we just need to trust in that good people are getting into the profession and that they care about relationships and they can do it?
I can remember a colleague saying way back when I actually started teaching, saying, and this is harder to do now, but nobody knows what happens in your classroom once you shut the door, other than you and the kids.
Yeah, that's true.
Nowadays, unfortunately, that doesn't hold true.
No.
Okay.
It's a powerful quote. And look, like you say, we'd love to hear from everyone out there in terms of the well-being, and it is a big push, but I also think it's the right push. But how do we effectively test it and survey it and get that data and those results without it, you know, as you spoke about at the start, John, you know, giving them that survey, there may be some kids going, you should already know this. You should already know how I feel about school and who I am and those sorts of things. So how do we effectively do that? It's a very open question. We're not looking for the answer right now, but something to consider. So if you've got any ideas out there or how you feel about it, we'd love to hear from you.
Well, Adam, we had to go back through the archives to work out whose anecdote it was. And Mm. It had to be yours, didn't it? First episode back. Anyway, I couldn't think of one, so it's up to you.
So it's over to me, and it was actually hard because I wanted to think of something a little bit Christmassy, and we've done a few different Christmas things before, Christmas presents and all those sorts of things. So I wanted to talk about, and you probably need to think very carefully about the stories you choose, but I wanted to talk about the school staff Christmas party. Now, we all have staff Christmas parties at the end of the year, some better than others, and I wanted to sort of throw it out to, have you got any wonderful memories or just even funny memories of things happening at Christmas parties that you've had before? Because we've all been to a lot of them at the end of the year, and not even just the novice, it might be the end of the very end of term where you have like a lunch and some of the things that sort of go on there, and think about any stories you might have from those. Because I know we recently had ours, because we've had a very small staff for a long time. So a lot of our Christmas parties have been a dinner somewhere, or even last year we went to the Great Ocean Road Chocolatiery place, and yep. So I did a bit of a tasting at dinner. But we actually went to the piano bar and had a raucous evening. So but people say it was the best night that they've had. Like, it was just everyone let their hair down, you know, and just enjoyed. There was no one did anything ridiculous, but just everyone had a good time. There was lots of laughter and going on, and you know, someone a shirt came off on the dance floor, and you know, doing all these sorts of things like that. But I just thought, for you guys over the years, were there any, not necessarily any raucous ones, but any Christmas parties you've been to that were just an absolute, that were a big fail, that you sort of went, you were excited for, and just went, this is just terrible. This is not working.
I think it's an interesting topic. You often see, I think there's articles in the newspapers every year about office, like the office party in inverted commas. And I have been at some over the years where I've stood there and thought, you know, you could be in a movie or a TV show with the Christmas party here, like with some of the cliches and things like that. I mean, obviously, we'll be professional here with what we talk about, but I do recall one, John, back when we worked together. I don't know whether you do. It was quite a low-key get-together, but I do remember the Kris Kringle. It was quite obvious. I think I've told this story before, so I won't go on too long, but the Kris Kringle, and it was quite obvious. It was a male-female gift setup where you had to buy a male gift and a female gift, and it was quite obvious what the male gifts entailed. They're all wrapped up, but I think, you know, you could certainly see some bottles of different types of alcoholic beverages. It was quite obvious, and I think my name came out first, and I was the first one to go and choose. So I thought I'd be fair and close my eyes, you know, and not just grab, you know, and be selfish and grab, you know, the wine or whatever. So I closed my eyes and grabbed something that, when I opened my eyes, clearly wasn't any of those things. And turned out, to cut a long story short, turned out to be a re-gift, I believe. One was a sunglasses holder that you clip to your dashboard in your car, and the other one was a clear plastic case that sat in your boot to put plants in from the nursery so your boot didn't get dirty. So
you have told us story before, but it never gets old. It's just
everybody else got the, beer
the,
and
you
wine.
Took a risk and you thought, I'm going to take a risk here. I could really pay off here, and you just, it just did, blew up in your face.
John, can you recall though any days where your Christmas party has gone past, you know?
No, I probably can't remember them. No, we were always nice. But I can, you speaking of Kris Kringles, I can recall one particular staff member at one particular school who was well known for being very quirky, but reasonably practical, and this was actually when you actually gave something to somebody, so it was a nominated person and everything. Anyway, everybody got to open their stuff in front of everybody. So this particular person was one of the administration, and that was given this box, which he opened and then took out. And can you remember the nodding dogs?
Yeah, I can. Yes.
It was a nodding dog. of course, the thing was that you had to say what you were going to use it for and where it would go and everything else.
Oh, no.
The breath went out of the room, you know. It was,
no.
And the dog was still nodding over.
He managed
to get through it. Because I've seen a similar one to that way back. This is way back in my first couple of years of teaching, where you did the Kris Kringle, and someone's obviously played a bit of a practical joke, but a very straight down the line older female teacher got, I don't know if you've seen those ones where it's the dog that's got little chocolate sultanas inside it, and to get one out, it comes out of its backside. And she got that. I remember her looking and going, oh, how do you use this? And someone going, well, actually, you do this. And it, oh, and not being too impressed, and everyone else just sort of trying to look away and have a bit of a giggle because she was going to get these chocolate sultanas. This dog's going to have to poo its head, its rear end there to get to it. But, you know, yeah.
Getting back to the Christmas party, I think it's like many Christmas parties, I think there is that element of always one or two people who has the blowout.
Yes.
So to speak, on the night. Yes. And I think it happens with teachers a lot because for some of us, we have years where there's a lot of pent-up stress or whether it's, you know, you've had a tough year or even just energy. And sometimes the Christmas party, I think it's still the wrong time to do it, but can be the time when it all comes out.
And it hits you harder because you're tired. You get to the end of the year and you've just done reports, you've done all these things, and you're tired. So what normally would be okay, you have a few and you start feeling it. And I always find, too, there's always one or two who you don't expect it from either. Have a big night, you sit there with your partner and go, gee, they're going a bit hard. I wouldn't have expected it of such and such.
If you take it to another level, particularly being teachers in the community, if you're at an establishment that is in that community or even nearby, there is always the chance of seeing the parents of the students who you teach. I know people we've worked with over the years have said if they've partied on that night, they've run into those people. And that's, you know, that's something that most people wouldn't get in their profession, you know, having to like negotiate that. Mm. So I think that's something I've always avoided.
Yeah, definitely.
Happily.
Has that ever happened to you, John? You know, one of those bumped into anyone?
No, not really.
No, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, not that I can recall. Let's put it that way.
We've all escaped unscathed, and we're better for it.
Yeah, we are better for it. So, look, I do want to hear though, because I think most probably would have had their Christmas party. I know we were at when we had ours, where there were two other schools there at the time with us as well. And so most of what they have this weekend. Have you got a bit of a funny story, just something going wrong, or even a Kris Kringle, or just, you know, anything that would have happened at a Christmas party that you necessarily didn't expect? We'd love to hear from you. So pop it on Facebook or pop it on the blog. So boys, so ends episode 18. It's been really good to be back in the chair after such a long hiatus. And I do want to finish really, really quickly by saying a big shout out to my principal, Julie, who's retiring after 8 years at our school. And it's just a quick one to say thank you for everything she's done. She's been terrific for the school. And she's got a wonderful sense of humour, and she's worked her backside off to make our school great. And over the years, we've gone from having 120 kids to now having close to 340 next year, and a lot of great programs. And we actually had a leadership meeting tonight before I came down, and where she was very happy to make the comment to say that this has easily been a best year, and just seeing the progression that we've made in a lot of things. So, Julie, this is my sort of shout out. All the best in your retirement, and I hope you enjoy every minute.
Yes, all the best, Julie, and an old colleague of yours, John, too.
Yeah. Can I just endorse Adam's kind thoughts there? And well done, Julie, on finally joining the ranks of teachers that have moved beyond the classroom and the school.
Yeah, that's exactly
it's
right.
It's a wonderful world, and your influence on me has been profound too. I enjoyed our times together at Bel Air, and also catching up with you occasionally when we've met in the street and the kind of things that you've said. So thanks very much.
Brilliant.
A huge milestone always, I would say. Thanks, Adam, for mentioning that. Now, looking ahead to next year, we're hoping that perhaps we could come at the podcast from any angle, couldn't we, Adam?
It could be
a series of one-off specials. It could be a regular episodes, but we're not sure how it's going to look. But we do believe, even with new children in the family in tow, that we may still try and get back on the podcast.
Because I think there's a little bit of a feeling, we feel a little bit rejuvenated. I think the time away is rejuvenated. So whether or not we do a couple in a row and then go away for a little while and come back, or we do one every couple of weeks, we don't want to put a timeline on it. We do have in the distance, we'd love to reach 100 episodes. You know, next one will be 81. So that's still a little way in the distance, but I think that's our goal.
So listeners, if you're out there, give us a little bit of support. We'd love you to even try and help us get to 100. And Adam, I know that at least one of us is going to be in a completely new role professionally next year. But at this stage, just in case we're not sure who's listening, or I'll just keep it under wraps, but something that I know one of us is quite excited about, but we might reveal.
Definitely.
That might be a good reason to come back in the new year.
Absolutely, it may be good. So and just before we say our goodbyes, I want to say if you want to share us on Facebook and tell any colleagues and do that sort of stuff, we'd love to continue to reach more people, because we are... That little time away has been really good, and we do want to reconnect with a lot of our listeners and a lot of educators in 2019 and beyond.
And John, I hope it's been fun.
As always, gentlemen. As always.
So, I'm going to finish. So, from me, Adam Lavaz.
And John Pearce.
Me, Rick Kayla Thompson, and this has been Two Regular Teachers.